What a tangle. What a strangling knot to be caught in. To be exiled here. To be stuck in Berlin with Vienna so near, yet so far from the Emperor's ear. What a strange and impossible sum. To be old while to still be so young. To have sung before speaking a word. To be heard, to be hailed, then to fail, to be done. To love, but to be so naive. To trust and to be so deceived. To mourn, forlorn, to be torn from you, scorned for another, who suffers no grief. To curse God seeking lightning and to still be ignored. To hide in this room now too rich to afford. To hear armies of creditors bang at the door, always yelling for more, and to have nothing to sell that could help, except for the Steinway that sits in the corner. For Arthur, it all came too easily to learn the scales in every key, to play the etudes and the suites, the nocturnes and the fantasy, to master the sonatas, minuets, and symphonies, to seek the truth in fits and starts, to strike the middle F like it's an arrow through the heart, to wing the right hand like a dove, and with a left a violent shove, to needle gently yet relentlessly with a steady foot upon the pedal, and to clench the iron fist inside the velvet glove, to learn to whisper and to scream, to let each yearning finger breathe, to burn, to worship, to mislead, to pose a question with a pinky on a key, to flee, to fight, to bleed, to float in air, nothing solid underneath, to wrap those heavy knuckles on the gate of heaven, till there's nothing left to achieve, but to go retrieve the length of cable hidden in the cabinet, to metamorphosize the twisted rope into an alphabet, to lay the lazy C upon the shabby wooden floor to rest, to send the end across the top and bend the C into an S, to curve the tail beneath the S, to turn the tangle to a B, to hug the wretched root around the fiber suffocatingly, to wrap again, to give the coil 7 loops, to penetrate the yawning hoop, to tug the loose appendage through, to yank the knot till it's ready for the job it's got to do, to toss the braid above the ceiling beam and to affix the noose, to bid adieu to all of you until there's nothing left to do but climb the chair, to cinch the collar, find the edge, to step into the air. Good evening, listeners. This is Professor Jonas Armitage, and you're listening to Stories from Dark Places. Tonight's poem is The Lovely Thing's Sweet Knots by George Watsky. Our story continues to be The King in Yellow by Robert Chambers. I hope you all had a wonderful Mother's Day. To those of you who are mothers, I hope your children thanked you for the gift of your love and care, and doted on you ever so. To those of you who have mothers, I hope you gave unto them praise and thanks for all of the things they have done, and would continue to do for you so long as their life enables them. Days like this, I find myself missing my mother, passed in an accident when I was just a boy. My memories of her are sparse, but the impressions I possess were that she was a kind, doting woman. I am grateful for what time I had with her, as limited as it may have been. We shall get to this evening's story after this brief word from our sponsors.
Soul crystal's not pure enough? Spirit rain journal's too smeared? Holy water looking murky? Then come to Verboten Knickknacks and Collectibles, home of the largest collection of arcane artifacts, cursed objects, and unearthly articles since the Pines Cryptid Museum disappeared with the rest of Ashley, Kansas. Hi, this is Kai the Intern. I wanted to tell you that Verboten Knickknacks and Collectibles has everything you could ever want. Whether you're a disciple of the Mad Arab himself, or a curious teenager looking to summon your first Shoggoth. I just bought a new corpse candle last week and it still looks new. You'd never know I'd summoned the dead twice this week already. Verboten Knickknacks and Collectibles, where the only thing you can't find is a bloated price tag.
At noon the next day, when I called, I found Boris walking restlessly about his studio. Genevieve is asleep just now, he's told me. The sprain is nothing. But why should she have such a high fever? The doctor can't account for it, or else he will not, he muttered. Genevieve has a fever? I asked. I should say so, and has actually been a little light-headed at intervals all night. The idea! Gay little Genevieve without a care in the world, and she keeps saying her heart's broken and she wants to die. My own heart stood still. Boris leaned against the door of his studio, looking down, his hands in his pockets, his kind, keen eyes clouded, a new line of trouble drawn over the mouth's good mark that made the smile. The maid had ordered to summon him the instant Genevieve opened her eyes. We waited and waited, and Boris, growing restless, wandered about fussing with modeling wax and red clay. Suddenly, he started for the next room. "Come and see my rose-colored bath, full of death!" he cried. "Is it death?" I asked, to humor his mood. "You are not prepared to call it life, I suppose," he answered. As he spoke, he plucked a solitary goldfish, squirming and twisting out of its globe. "We'll send this one after the other, wherever that is," he said. There was feverish excitement in his voice. A dull weight of fever lay on my limbs and on my brain as I followed him to the fair crystal pool with its pink-tinted sides. And he dropped the creature in. Falling, its scales flashed with a hot orange gleam in its angry twistings and contortions. The moment it struck the liquid, it became rigid and sank heavily to the bottom. Then came the milky foam, the splendid hues radiating on the surface, and then the shaft of pure serene light broke through from seemingly infinite depths. Boris plunged in his hand and drew out an exquisite marble thing, blue-veined, rose-tinted, and glistening with opalescent drops. "Child's play," he muttered, and looked wearily, longingly at me, as if I could answer such questions. But Jack Scott came in and entered into the game, as he called it, with ardor. Nothing would do but to try the experiment on a white rabbit then and there. I was willing that Boris should find distraction from his cares, but I hated to see the life go out of a warm, living creature, and I declined to be present. Picking up a book at random, I sat down in the studio to read. Alas, I had found The King in Yellow. After a few moments, which seemed ages, I was putting it away with a nervous shudder when Boris and Jack came in bringing their marble rabbit. At the same time, the bell rang above, and a cry came from the sick room. Boris was gone like a flash, and the next moment he called, "Jack, run for the doctor! Bring him back with you! Alec, come here!" I went and stood at her door. A frightened maid came out in haste and ran away to fetch some remedy. Genevieve, sitting bolt upright, with crimson cheeks and glittering eyes, babbled incessantly and resisted Boris's gentle restraint. He called me to help. At my first touch, she sighed and sank back, closing her eyes. And then, as we still bent over her, she opened them again, looked straight into Boris's face, the poor fever-crazed girl, and told her secret. At the same instant, our three lives turned into new channels. The bond that held us so long together snapped forever, and a new bond was forged in its place. For she had spoken my name, and as the fever tortured her, her heart poured out its load of hidden sorrow. Amazed and dumbfounded, I bowed my head, while my face burned like a live coal, and the blood surged in my ears, stupefying me with its clamor. Incapable of movement, incapable of speech, I listened to her feverish words in an agony of shame and sorrow. I could not silence her, and I could not look at Boris. Then I felt an arm upon my shoulder, and Boris turned a bloodless face to mine. "It is not your fault, Alec. Don't grieve so if she loves you." But he could not finish. And as the doctor stepped swiftly into the room, saying, "Ah, the fever!" I seized Jack Scott and hurried him to the street, saying Boris would rather be alone. We crossed the street to our own apartments, and that night, seeing I was going to be ill too, he went for the doctor again. The last thing I recollected with any distinctness was hearing Jack say, "For heaven's sake, doctor, what ails him to wear a face like that?" And I thought of the King in Yellow and the pallid mask. I was very ill for the strain of 2 years which I have endured since that fatal May morning when Genevieve murdered I love you, but I think I love Boris best, told on me at last. I had never imagined that I would become more than I could endure. Outwardly tranquil, I had deceived myself. Though the inward battle raged night after night, and I, lying alone in my room,
cursed myself for rebellious thoughts unloyal to Boris and unworthy of Genevieve. The morning always brought relief, and I returned to Genevieve and to my dear Boris with a heart washed clean by the tempests of the night. Never in word or deed or thought, while with them, had I betrayed my sorrow, even to myself. The mask of self-deception was no longer a mask for me. It was a part of me. Night lifted it, laying bare the stifled truth below. But there was no one to see except myself, and when the day broke, the mask fell back again on its own accord. Those thoughts passed through my troubled mind as I lay sick. But they were hopelessly entangled with visions of white creatures, heavy as stone, crawling about in Boris's basin. Of the wolf's head on the rug, foaming and snapping at Genevieve, who lay smiling beside it. I thought, too, of the king in yellow, wrapped in the fantastic colors of his tattered mantle, and that bitter cry of Cassilda, "Not upon us, O king, not upon us!" Feverishly I struggled to put it from me, but I saw the lake of holly, thin and blank, without a ripple or wind to stir it, and I saw the towers of Carcosa behind the moon. Aldebaran, the Hyades, Elar, Hastur, glided through the cloud rifts which fluttered and flapped as they passed into the scalloped tatters of the king in yellow. Among all these, one sane thought persisted. It never wavered. No matter what else was going on in my disordered mind, that my chief reason for existing was to meet some requirement of Boris and Genevieve. What this obligation was, its nature, was never clear. Sometimes it seemed to be protection, sometimes support through a great crisis. Whatever it seemed to be for the time, its weight rested only on me, and I was never so ill or so weak that it did not respond with my whole soul. There were always crowds of faces about me, mostly strange, but a few I recognized, Boris among them. Afterward, they told me that this could not have been, but I know that once at least he bent over me. It was only a touch, faint echo of his voice. Then the clouds settled back on my senses and I lost him. But he did stand there and bend over me once at least. At last, one morning, I awoke to find the sunlight fading across my bed and Jack Scott reading beside me. I had not strength enough to speak aloud, neither could I think, much less remember, but I could smile feebly as Jack's eye met mine, and when he jumped up and asked eagerly if I wanted anything, I could whisper, "Yes, Boris." Jack moved to the head of my bed and leaned down to arrange my pillow. I did not see his face, but he answered heartily, "You must wait, Alec. You're too weak to see even Boris." I waited, and I grew strong in a few days, and I was able to see who I would, but meanwhile I had thought and remembered. From the moment when all the past grew clear again in my mind, I never doubted what I should do when the time came, and I felt sure that Boris would have resolved upon the same course, so far as he was concerned. As for what pertained to me alone, I knew he would see that I also as I did. I no longer asked for anyone. I never inquired why no message came from them, why during the week I lay there, waiting, growing stronger, I never heard their name spoken. Preoccupied with my own searchings for the right of way, and with my feeble but determined fight against despair, I simply acquiesced in Jack's reticence, taking for granted that he was afraid to speak of them. Taking for granted that he was afraid to speak of them, lest I should turn unruly and insist on seeing them. Meanwhile, I said over and over to myself, how would it be when life began again for us all? What would take up our relations exactly as they were before Genevieve fell ill? Boris and I would look into each other's eyes. There would be neither rancor, nor cowardice, nor mistrust in that glance. I would be with them again for a little while in the dear intimacy of their home, and then, without pretext or explanation, I would disappear from their lives forever. Boris would know. Genevieve, the only comfort was that she would never know. It seemed, as I thought it over, that I had found the meaning of that sense of obligation which had persisted all through my delirium, and the only possible answer to it. So when I was quite ready, I beckoned Jack to me one day, and said Jack. I want Boris at once, and take my dearest greeting to Genevieve. When at last he made me understand that they were both dead, I fell into a wild rage that tore all my little convalescent strength to atoms. I raved and cursed myself into a relapse from which I crawled forth some weeks after, a boy of 21 who believed that his youth was gone forever. I seemed to be past the capability of further suffering, and one day when Jack handed me a letter and the keys to Boris's house, I took them without a tremor and asked him to tell me all. It was cruel of me to ask him, but there was no help for it, and he leaned wearily on his thin hands to reopen the wound which could never entirely heal. He began very quietly. Alec, unless you have a clue that I know nothing at all, you will not be able to explain any more than I what has happened. I suspect that you would rather not hear these details, but if you must learn them, else I would spare you the relation. God knows I wish I could be spared the telling. I shall use few words. The day when I left you in the doctor's care and came back to Boris, I found him working on the fates. Genevieve, he said, was sleeping under the influence of drugs. She had been quite out of her mind, he said. He kept on working, not talking any more, and I watched him. Before long, I saw that the third figure of the group, one looking straight ahead out over the world, bore his face, not as you ever saw it, but as it looked then and to the end. This is one thing for which I should like to find an explanation, but I never shall. Well, he worked, and I watched him in silence, and we went out that way until nearly midnight. Then we heard the door open and shut sharply, and a swift rush in the next room. Boris sprang through the doorway, and I followed, but we were too late. She lay at the bottom of the pool, her hands across her breast. And then Boris shot himself through the heart. Jack stopped speaking. Drops of sweat stood under his eyes, and his thin cheeks twitched. I carried Boris to his room. Then I went back and let that hellish fluid out of the pool and turned on all the water, washed the marble clean of every drop, and when at length I dared descend the steps, I found her lying there as white as snow. At last, when I had decided what was best to do, I went to the laboratory, first emptied the solution into the basin and into the waste pipe, and then I poured the contents of every jar and bottle after it. There was wood in the fireplace, so I burnt a fire, and breaking the locks on Boris's cabinet, burned every paper, notebook, and letter that I found there. With a mallet from the studio, I smashed to pieces the empty bottles, loaded them into a coal scuttle, and I carried them to the cellar and threw them over the red-hot bed of the furnace. 6 times I made that journey, and at last not a vestige remained of anything which might again aid in seeking for the formula which Boris had found. Then at last I dared call the doctor. He is a good man. Together we struggled to keep it from the public. Without him I never could have succeeded. At last we got the servants paid, sent away into the country, where old Rosé keeps them quiet with stories of Boris and Genevieve's travels in distant lands, from whence they will not return. We buried Boris in the little cemetery of Sevres. The doctor is a good creature and knows when to pity a man who can bear no more. He gave his certificate of heart disease and asked no question of me. Then, lifting his head from his hands, he said, "Open the letter, Alec. It is for us both." I tore it open. It was Boris's will, dated a year before. He left everything to Genevieve, and in the case of her dying childless, I was to take control of the house in Rue St. Cecile, and Jack Scott the management at Ept. On our deaths, the property reverted to his mother's family in Russia, with the exception of the sculptured marbles executed by himself. These he left to me. The page blurred under our eyes. Jack got up and walked to the window. Presently he returned and sat down again. I dreaded to hear what he was going to say, but he spoke with the same simplicity and gentleness. Genevieve lies before the Madonna in the marble room. The Madonna bends tenderly above her, and Genevieve smiles back into that calm face that never would have been except for her. His voice broke, but he grasped my hand, saying, "Courage, Alec." Next morning, he left for Ept to fulfill his trust.
What a sad and unexpected turn of events. We knew that our main character possessed a deep love for Genevieve and had buried it to honor his friend. I was certainly not expecting her to reveal that this love she had denied burned so strongly in her that she was willing to take her own life because she could not be with him without betraying the man whom she had given herself to and had treated her so well, nor that Boris would take his own life afterward. A very sad thing, Romeo and Juliet, in many ways. Lovers, lives cut short by love, and life and death. This would seem to be the end of a story, but there is at least one more segment of the mask left for us, and we shall explore it on next week's broadcast. But this is an end, or it is all the time we have now. Good night, listeners. And please remember, when you are in bed at night, there is the creak of the hallway floor, the groan of an opening door, and the shuffle of something across the carpet as it approaches you. Remember this, there is nothing to be afraid of. After all, some of the best things only happen in the dark.
Stories from Dark Places was recorded before an imaginary studio audience. All stories performed on this podcast have express written consent from the original owner. Jonas Armitage, his studio manager, and the entire staff of WZHP Radio Innsmouth are fictitious characters, and it's probably for the best that you continue to believe that.
Hello, listeners. Looking for more tales to entertain with esoteric delight and supernatural suspense? I would encourage you to check out Peculiar Stories. Join Indiana Beckett as she takes you on a walk around her particular side of the neighborhood in all things strange and unusual. You may find her on Anchor Podcasts or anywhere that your podcast can be found.